WIOX is supported by you and the following underwriters. The Catskill Mountain Foundation, celebrating decades of arts on the mountaintop with countless performances, classes, and community events each year, from Grammy Award-winning music to dance and art classes for all ages, including classical music, April in Paris, a romantic conversation, and musical stroll through the City of Lights with musicologist Dr. Jeffrey Lanford and pianist Dr. Joanne Polk, Saturday, April 13th at 2 p.m. More information at CatskillMTN.org. Nainu, the shop of Mother Earth, a Peruvian boutique for clothing and hats, blankets and bags, rugs, pillows and decorative pieces using sustainable organic materials. Nainu, the shop of Mother Earth, Main Street in Margaretville, New York, 917-701-2496, 917-701-2496. Rick's Tire Service, family-owned and operated on State Route 30 between Roxbury and Grand Gorge. Tires, mounting, and wheel balancing for cars, trucks, lawn, garden, farm, and construction vehicles. Open Monday through Friday, 8 to 5, Saturday, 8 till noon. More information at 800-LG-TIRES, 800-LG-TIRES. This is WIOX Roxbury, your live and local soundtrack for winter in the Catskills. As you cruise through local towns and villages like Delhi, Davenport, Stamford, Hobart, for rare books, bright lights, meditative days, and karaoke nights. Find links to winter happenings in the Catskills at WIOXradio.org.
Listening to WIOX Community Radio, live and local in the Catskill Mountains at 91.3 FM and MTC Cable Channel 20, 107.5 FM on the campus of SUNY Delhi, and everywhere at WIOXradio.org on computers or smartphones. This is From the Forest. Every Wednesday, 6 to 7 p.m., talk about a different forest-related topic with Ryan and John. John, how's it going?
Going good, Ryan. What's up?
What's up? I'm just restocking my firewood pile. It's almost done, and sapwood, you know, which I'm not going to burn as much, but got some hemlock.
Cool.
Went back in the woods, got last year's trees that I took the bark off of. Turns out when you take the bark off trees, I mean, this is out, you're going to say, yeah, they really do dry a lot faster.
Yeah. Were they up off the ground a little bit too? Were they?
No.
No?
Oh, I have trees in the back I can't get to behind my house that I debarked, maybe 7 years ago. Mm-hmm. They don't rot really too much.
Yeah, I've passed by some of yours from a long time ago over in the Margaretville area.
Where? Oh, in Greenhalls?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah, yeah.
I forgot about those.
Yeah, I don't know, walk up there, I don't know, every now and then, and They're there.
Yeah, there's one I couldn't get the bark off. You can see I used the chainsaw on it. That was a mistake.
Girdled it.
Yeah. But got a full show tonight. We're talking to we're talking about the Aldo Leopold and the importance of conservation with Steve Swenson. Steve is the program director there, and he oversees the foundation's marketing, communications, facilities, education and outreach, and land stewardship. He holds a BS degree in environmental science from the University of Wisconsin, Green Bay, and an MS in ecology from Ohio State University. And let me see if I can get Steve on. Steve, are you there? Can you hear us?
Yes, I am, Ryan.
All right. How are you?
Great. Thank you for having me on the program. I really appreciate the invite.
Thank you for taking the time. And where are you calling from?
I'm calling from Baraboo, Wisconsin. I am just a mile away from Aldo Leopold's historic shack.
All right. So what's the weather like out there?
Well, today it's been good. It got sunny, and we're up to, you know, the mid-30s and maybe touching 40 degrees here. But we had a very warm winter, which you probably are aware of, and maybe you experienced some of that yourself. Almost a snowless winter this year. It was really shocking.
Yeah. Yeah, it did.
Yeah, same here. Today's a little warmer than you, 44 and drizzling rain.
Yeah, a lot of rain. Steve, what, before we get into the meat of the show, you know, what got you into this field of study?
Well, you know, I think it was camping experiences as a kid, spending time out in nature. You know, I was a rambunctious young boy, and I enjoyed being active, and I particularly enjoyed sort of investigating out in nature. And so my parents owned 40 acres, still do, same 40 acres outside of my hometown that had was forested, is still forested. And so we'd go out there on weekends and romp around, and really I think that was the beginning of it.
Yeah, and then is that you're from Ohio then, I take it, or somewhere else?
No, I am from Wisconsin. I grew up in the center part of the state and went to school here in the state over at Green Bay, and did a degree in everything that had to do with ecology. There is a more traditional natural resources school in Wisconsin, Stevens Point, more traditionally aligned with forestry and wildlife ecology, water management, and I was more interested in ecology. I was interested in the whole system, and so I got that degree in 1995 and then spent some time with a nonprofit learning how conservation really works, and that got me excited to further advance that at Ohio State with a degree in ecology from there as well.
One more question before I ask you about what the Aldo Leopold Foundation is. As a person who doesn't know anything about Wisconsin, I look at the map, and maybe you can answer this. Why is the Upper Peninsula a part of Michigan and not Wisconsin?
Well, that was a land deal. That was a land deal. There was a fight down there on the southern border of Ohio and Michigan. And a consolation prize out of that battle was that Michigan got the Upper Peninsula.
Yeah, it makes no sense. I was looking at that one day. I'm like, wait a second. What's going on there?
Yeah.
All right. That's all I got. All right. So what is the Aldo Leopold Foundation?
Well, the Aldo Leopold Foundation is headquartered here in Baraboo, Wisconsin, and it is the home site to Aldo Leopold's weekend retreat from Too Much Modernity, as he writes in his book. So we're just north of Madison, which is where he was professionally a professor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. And so we have the historic site and are the executors of his literary estate, so all of his writings. And we are in pursuit of a land ethic across our country using the legacy of Aldo Leopold. And so we really want to promote this relationship between people and the natural world, and we do that in any number of ways, which we'll get to in our conversation tonight. But that is the thrust of our organization's mission.
Yeah, I guess, you know, for people who, you know, I heard of Aldo Leopold going to school. John just reread the Sand County Almanac, but how would you describe Aldo Leopold?
Well, he was a thought leader for his time, and in some ways still is. And so people refer to him as the father of wildlife ecology or the father of wilderness, two ideas that he was very intimately associated with in the, and at the beginning of both of those, in fact, started both of those. The Gila Wilderness down in southwest New Mexico turns 100 this year. It was first proposed by Aldo Leopold in 1922. It became a wilderness in 1924, so it's 100 years this year. And that was our world's first designated wilderness. And then in the 30s, he was associated with wildlife ecology and started the first ever wildlife ecology program at that time called Game Management. So it was the Department of Game Management at the University of Wisconsin-Madison in 1933 was the first program of its kind in the world. And so he is considered both the father of wildlife ecology as well as wilderness.
Yeah, he was the Sand County Almanac. That was one of my required texts for 101 class in wildlife management. So it's still being talked about today. There's no doubt. I reread the book in the last few days, knowing you were coming on. It's a very short read. Great read. A lot of topics and conversations that Ryan and I were discussing on the truck here are still being talked about today. So
yeah,
whether that's good or bad, I mean, meaning bad is, did we not get anywhere yet? Like, what the heck? But it's still being talked about.
Well, John, you're exactly right. That was his masterpiece. So in a career that spanned from the teens, the 19-teens to 48 when he passed, he was a writer. And he was a thinker, and he put a lot of his thoughts into essays written very poetically, and captured his relationship to the natural world, but also his clarion call, that trumpet call to the masses out there. How do I put this into words that develop this relationship between people and land, expressing his own love of land and the natural world, but trying to get instill that in others. And so it ends with the big idea. Sand County Almanac ends with the big idea, which is the land ethic, this inexorable link that we have to the natural world. And if only we recognized it and embraced it, we'd live in a much different world.
How would you put Aldo Leopold in context? Like, you know, during the 30s and 40s, I mean, what was the consensus surrounding these words, conservation, the environment, ecology? You know, how were people looking at land, I guess?
Well, that is a really great question. When Leopold transitioned from his federal position in the Southwest as a forester, working for the Forest Service, and transitioned to the Midwest, where he continued to work for the Forest Service at the Forest Products Lab, but then after that short stint, he did a survey for a manufacturer of ammunition throughout the Midwest. And in doing that, he had this great comparison between what it was like to manage vast landscapes like the Southwest and on national forest lands, and comparatively, the surveying throughout the Midwest, which was predominantly privately owned and small parcels. And it was the birth of this idea and realizing that it was going to take something different in a Midwestern or an Eastern landscape where most of the land is privately owned, and realizing that it was going to take something within landowners to change how land was being managed. So back then, they were losing soil, and they didn't know why. And it wasn't people were intentionally ruining their land. Of course that was not happening. They were acting with farm practices that they thought were the right thing to do, so they were plowing up and down hillsides, and as a result they were losing soil in vast quantities every year, and it was a critical need for conservationist efforts to intervene. And that was the Toon Valley Project, which you may or may not be aware of, that happened out in the Driftless area of Wisconsin, which is very hilly landscape. And they did all sorts of practices to reverse that trend of soil loss. And those practices are still in place today. Hmm. So that's one example of what the context was like. I think the other one that's very important and came out of the game survey is that wildlife that was being hunted up until the 20s and the 30s, species were under threat of extinction, passenger pigeon among them, and one that most listeners would be aware of. And it was thought that protection of those species was the way in which to make sure that those populations stayed around. But it turned out in the game survey that Leopold did in the 1930s, he came up with a novel idea and understanding that it was habitat. In fact, habitat, the places where these birds and other wildlife had their young, that was critically important to their perpetuation over time. And so that was a very novel idea for its time, that habitat. And, of course, you say that today and people know exactly what you're talking about. So those are two really good examples of the context in which he worked and how his novel ideas and understanding kind of fit the moment.
Hmm. Yeah, I don't know, wildlife ecology, what would you say about that in habitat, John? I mean, what are you...
I mean, it's definitely something under-talked about in a lot of fields. You know, the first thing you hear about is protect it, right? Endangered Species Act. When people think of that, I think just think about the protection side of it, but not the work that goes into restoration and habitat and loss, what got us there. That needs to be talked about in broader context.
Yeah, I feel like we're really good at regulating a species, but not necessarily providing the habitat. You know, timber rattlesnakes in New York State come to mind.
Well, I mean, Leopold, I wrote down some quotes as I was reading this book again, and he states, you know, we only grieve for what we know. And he talks about that in his land ethic, right? It's like people care about certain things, but if they don't know the whole realm of ecological existence and how everything ties together, we're only going to care about these little snippets, whatever you care about. He talked about grouse or maybe deer or whatever. But what does a grouse need? What about its whole life cycle and food and habitat and everything that goes into that? And that's all part of this equation, right?
So, Steve, I mean, this kind of is a good segue to the next topic, conservation versus preservation. You know, in New York State, I don't know about Wisconsin, but we're pretty good at telling someone not to do something, not to shoot deer, you know, protecting the timber rattlesnake, whatnot, but not so in encouraging private landowners to foster habitat that would foster that wildlife species. That's kind of like conservation, but I won't speak for you. How would you describe conservation?
Well, you know, to me, conservation is maintaining natural resources, fisheries, you know, wildlife management, water, soil, forest. But it does imply some things. It implies a human involvement, that there's something going on there, an interaction between humans and the natural world, often implies the utilization, but it could also just be a mutualistic relationship that one has to the land and a reason to maintain it.
Yeah. How would you decipher from preservation then?
Well, preservation, could be interpreted in any number of ways, of course.
Yeah.
It probably means a lot of different things to people because there are still forest preserves, and of course you have them in New York State. But I don't think people interpret that use of preserve as we're going to put a fence around it and we're not taking anything out of it and we're not going in there. But I think the preservation implies something of we're setting this aside, we're fencing it off literally or figuratively. We're going to try not to impact it anyway or have any negative impact on it through our relationship with that piece of land. And that just doesn't seem very tenable in today's world, of course, with climate change. There's probably not a square acre on the planet that's not impacted in some way by human influence. And so preservation doesn't seem like a term that's very useful anymore. Maybe there are some examples of it that it's happening and it's possible and it's worthwhile. But I think there's a little bit, you broke it, you bought it, and whether breaking it, we've really broken it, or we just need to make sure that the pieces hold together because they don't happen naturally is part of the way we see it, that we just have to make sure that these pieces are still on the landscape.
Do you think we broke it? I mean, do you think it was ever broken? I mean, what does that mean? I mean, is nature more resilient, or is You know, because it kind of like gets back to the original sin, like Garden of Eden, like did we really break it? And do you think that anywhere in Wisconsin wasn't touched by humans at one time? I mean, was there ever a time when humans weren't influencing the woods of Wisconsin or even most of New York State? I don't know. Some people might, you know, maybe think otherwise. I don't know.
You know, I think that's a debatable fact. I mean, our evidence goes back tens of thousands of years here in Wisconsin, and then prior to that, we had a major glaciation over almost the entire state of Wisconsin. So, in some ways, some of that is academic. If and when that first interaction between humans and nature happened, because today it is what it is, and that presence has been here for tens of thousands of years. And prior to European settlement, we had natural landscapes across Wisconsin based on the original surveys that were done when the land was platted. And so we've got great data sets from there. There was a lot of natural lands and natural plant communities across Wisconsin. It was, by all measure, a pretty diverse and functioning system, and certainly humans were here. So we don't begrudge humans being part of the equation. In fact, I think that's just not even possible in today's world, that is part of the equation and should be and actually needs to be if we're going to conserve what we've got.
Yeah. I guess here's another part. Who do you think's winning the conservation versus preservation? I mean, you probably know of the battle between John Muir, the preservationist, versus Gifford Pinchot back in the day. Who do you think is winning the battle today? If you think there's even a battle going on?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't pay a lot of attention to, sort of the academic battles on some of that or even the news clips. I mean, I think a lot of that's sound bites. What I see in my work, both in Wisconsin and with partners across the country, is that most people are, realizing that it's a conservationist approach that is most likely to protect diversity for the future. I mean, I think that's the piece that we've been adding here is that, conservation includes all the things that we started talking about with the fisheries and the wildlife management and the water and where we got our start, like in projects like Coon Valley in the 1930s, where it was just about the soil. But now today it's gotten to be biodiversity, it's gotten to be processes. And I think most people realize that it's not in the fencing off of these areas that we achieve those. It's in the management.
Hmm. Yeah.
So tell us about this land ethic as Aldo Leopold describes it. Because, I mean, as I read it, it basically agreed to some extent what you just said. It's bringing the idea of bringing people back into this equation and the mindset of people that if anything's going to change, we have to bring ourselves into the environment, and it's not something that we just look at from afar and visit every now and then.
Yeah, I mean, a couple of things. On the philosophical side, the land ethic is not just caring about nature. It's more than that. It goes beyond that to include in your community and in your conception of what a community is, the land, the water, the plants, the animals, nature. It is realizing that they have just as much right and reason to be included in the community as we do. And therefore, because we are dominant within that, we need to make measure and include them and find ways to conserve them and make sure that they too are protected and their integrity is protected into the future. And that's where the action comes in. And it is this pursuit of a land ethic that I think Leopold was after when he bought the shack property. He bought it for its lack of goodness and was putting back the pieces that are being lost elsewhere with shovel and axe, as he wrote in the Fan County Almanac.
Yeah.
Ratty writes, a true conservationist is one who signs his name with an axe, not a pen. Something along those lines.
Yeah.
I like that.
Yeah.
Do you think people are embracing the land ethic?
Yeah. I do. I mean, I think there's all sorts of bad press clippings to be had out there. But certainly if we look back at what the land looked like in 1930s when Coon Valley Project was happening, and it wasn't just Coon Valley where that was happening, it was all across Wisconsin, all across the agricultural states. Certainly was worse in a place like Coon Valley, which was a very hilly country. But when you look at the practices that they put in place, they're still 85 years later, they're still in place. And when you drive across the countryside, you see farms that, although they are not perfect, and there's still progress to be made, there is a conservation ethic sewn into the fabric of our country. I do believe that. Yeah. Also, with respect to wildlife, I think we've proven that we can maintain wildlife populations, that they can come back from recovery. Sandhill Crane, Aldo Leopold's wonderful essay, Marshland Elegy, is an elegy for cranes. He thought they were going to go extinct. He, by his estimation, there were 36 pairs of cranes left in Wisconsin. Maybe 150 total birds in the entire population, the eastern population. There are now 100,000. And it is through habitat, wetlands, being protected and also recreated, that birds like that have come back. So I think there are signs for success that we could point to.
What did Aldo Leopold think, or the foundation today, think about how like private property fits into the conservation paradigm?
Well, you know, we have a thing at the foundation that we don't speak on behalf of Aldo Leopold, but
that's probably good.
Yeah, it's probably a smart thing.
Yeah,
but certainly he was a private landowner. He wanted to put his hands in the dirt and see what he could do himself. He was definitely a doer. And so he valued the role of private landowners. In fact, that's part of his call at the end of the Stand County Almanac, is to say this is something that people should be doing. And it shouldn't just be the economics, and it shouldn't just be looking at land as a commodity, but there's something in your heart that will develop, and you will find purpose and meaning in caring for the land. And so certainly championing the role of private landowners is something that was important to Aldo Leopold, profiled heavily in the Sand County Almanac. He realized that was a necessary ingredient in the Midwestern landscape for sure.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, and he even questioned, you know, for the first time that I think there's probably a novel idea at the time of a public resource being paid for and conservation taking place on mostly private land. And how does this payback happen in association to the conservation work, you know?
Well, I mean, right. I mean, there are programs out there that can help offset the cost, the economic cost of non-commercial practices. Is that kind of what you're getting at?
Well, I'm just stating that he's the first one to my knowledge that was bringing up this type of thought, and this is where we've become, right? We've gotten, you know, the USDA has plenty of programs like you're describing to pay private landowners for some of their practices, but you know, he kind of brought up that idea, as far as I know.
Yeah, I mean, it was certainly part of the Coon Valley experiment. I mean, they said to the landowners, we will pay for the entirety of the practice if you keep it in for 5 years. And after 5 years, you can take it out. Well, 85 years later, they didn't. And so there's still strip cropping out there and grassy waterways and buffer strips along the waterways and all sorts of practices that are still in place.
Are they still in place because they make, you know, sense economically over time, or is it just for wildlife or something else?
No, I think it's good economic sense. I mean, people have realized that you can't just farm right up to the creek's edge and expect that, you know, you're not going to lose soil. And so I think that, again, I think it's a sign that the conservation ethic has penetrated that community and communities of agricultural communities across the country in this particular example, in ways that, you know, had its start in the 30s and continue today. It doesn't, again, it doesn't mean that there isn't progress to be made, but at the time we're moving in the right direction.
Yeah. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to From the Forest. Tonight's topic is Aldo Leopold and the importance of conservation with Steve Swenson. And up next, I want to ask Steve about the shack and the Leopold Pines conservation area.
All programs. This is a radio cast on pirate satellite. Orbiting your living room, cashing in the Bill of Rights. Human army surplus or refusing of the lights. This is radio cast on pirate satellite. Is an urban Vietnam, giving deadly exhibitions of murder by napalm.
This is From the Forest, every Wednesday, 6 to 7 p.m. Talk about a different forest-related topic with Ryan and John. Tonight's topic is Aldo Leopold and the importance of conservation with Steve Swenson. So, Steve, what is the Shack Leopold Pines Conservation Area?
Well, the Shack is the historic structure that Aldo Leopold and his family, wife and five children, spent their weekends and spring breaks visiting. And so, as I mentioned earlier, in 1933, Leopold has the first professorship in game management at the University of Wisconsin down in Madison, and that's 45 minutes south of here. And he's looking for a piece of property, and he wants something, as he said back then, remote and hard to get to. And he grew up along the Mississippi River in Burlington, Iowa, so it should not surprise us that he found this worn-out piece of land that was, at the time, remote and hard to get to along the Wisconsin River. And so, middle of February, he comes out there with his family in 1935, and there is this worn-out, worn-down little cabin on the property. It's tiny. It's probably 15 by 12 or something like that. And opens up the front door and says, "This is perfect." And I think his family thought he should be committed, but nonetheless, they stuck with it. And the Shack is the icon for the experience. The Shack is nice enough to get away from the mosquitoes, nice enough to get away from the rain, spend the night in there, but not so nice that that's where you spend your weekend. So it was the portal to the property, and they spent their time caring for the land, planting trees, planting prairie, caring for the place. And the first portion of a Sand County Almanac, the almanac part one, is the months of the year and beautiful little essays that capture what their family did at the Shack. And so this place-based literature that Sand County Almanac has come to represent, and this place that it was written about, is a bit of a mecca for people who like Aldo Leopold, love his writing, and want to visit the place that inspired a classic piece of literature. So that's the Shack.
What year is that Shack built, you know? I'm sure you do.
Well, we don't know exactly, but we called it at one time the only chicken coop that's on the National Historic Register. And I was sort of joking, because when the family got there, it did have chicken manure in it and all sorts of other kind of manure. But we've had enough historians that have come through the Shack that said, well, you know, it's just a little too nice. It has some framing to it that's quite nice. It's regular height for, you know, a human being and not a chicken coop necessarily, that would be shorter in stature. So we've had these historians come through and they say, well, we think it's a little too nice to be a chicken coop in its first life. We think what happened was this was the original building on the property, probably 1860s, 70s. And when the house on the hill got built, so there is a place not too far up a hill where there's a foundation. That's all that's left of that house. But once that was built, then they moved out of the Shack and moved into the house. And then the Shack became an outbuilding and eventually a livestock building. And so we think 1860s, 1870s, one of the original buildings on the site.
Wow. How's the upkeep on that? Probably takes a while, huh?
There's not a lot of upkeep. You know, we've got this really great historic structures report, very technical, but it ends with this line that the Shack shall remain in a steady state of disrepair. So we want to maintain it, to maintain its integrity. We do put a new roof on it. We've oiled the exterior, but we certainly aren't looking to improve it at all. And until something breaks, we don't replace it. So there's a number of quirks and about the building, but they're all part of its character and history. So it is in quite good shape, actually. It does get wet because it doesn't have paint on the exterior. It's got oil, so it does get wet, but it dries out. And we make sure that it has good airflow around it. Foundation is solid. We've done a number of things to make sure it's got some protections that way from the elements.
So what's the conservation area that I assume surrounds the Shack look like?
Yeah, so the Leopold Pines Conservation Area is named after Nina Leopold Bradley, who was one of the daughters of Aldo and Estella Leopold, and she lived here from the 70s until her passing in 2010. And the other name, Pines, is Philip Pines, who was a neighbor, and it just happened to be a neighbor, and they became fast friends because of the cranes. And so in the fall, cranes migrate out of Wisconsin and to points south of here. But they do this wonderful thing, which is stage for weeks on end on the islands in the Wisconsin River. And they're fattening up for their migration. And so they're spending the evenings away from predators out on the islands. And then during the day, they make these short commutes out to the farm fields, in particular corn fields, and fatten up. But then they do that nightly, daily for 6 to 8 weeks. And so Nina and Philip would get together on the banks of the Wisconsin River and watch the cranes come in the evening. And both of them have passed now, but both of our families, the Leopold family and the foundation and the Pines family, are very committed to conservation in the spirit of both of those individuals. And so we have recently christened the Leopold Pines Conservation Area. It is 4,000 acres that surrounds the historic site. And it is blessed with a very sandy outwash of Glacial Lake, Wisconsin. And so it's very, from a fertility standpoint, very poor soil, but absolutely perfect for grasslands, savannas, oak woodlands. And so we manage for those habitats, those plant communities.
What type of work does that entail for the management?
Well, all sorts of stuff. You know, our landscape was heavily manipulated over the years in various ways, from grazing to, you know, no fire. And so we've got collections of species that are results of that, either a lot of woody species on the landscape that otherwise it would have been prairie or savanna, much more open because fire would have kept it open. But nonetheless, it has succumbed to brush and tree growth that isn't particularly directional towards a forest, and they certainly in the New York sense, definitely not that type of forest. We grow a much poorer sort of. It wasn't doing much really for biodiversity. Pushing the land in the direction of grassland savanna has been much more productive, and so forest management. We do a lot of prescribed fire. We do a lot of brush management, both by hand, but also with something called a Feton mower. So it's this big drum on the front of a skid steer that spins very fast and has these big teeth, and so it can break up the brush and reduce it to shavings, basically. And we can burn through those areas after that. We also do a lot of prairie restoration, and so we're putting back the species that have been lost. And so there's not a seed bank there to recover. In most cases, and so we've got to put back the prairie and savanna seeds, the wildflowers, the grasses that were there historically.
How many people visit about a year to see the shack?
We get, you know, about 3,000 to 5,000 people per year that come through. They take a self-guided tour. You can check us out on aldoleopold.org and find out our tour schedule. We'll open again here in May for visitation.
What are people most surprised when they go there? What are they most surprised about?
Well, I think they're surprised at the size of the shack. It is small. And I think the other thing that's really wonderful is the landscape is quite subtle. It's not mountainous. You know, it's not going to make a postcard necessarily in the traditional sense. And that subtlety is juxtaposed to, you know, Leopold's writing and the importance of his writing and how it emerged from this place and their experience as a family there caring for a place, I think is just striking to many people. And they love visiting for that reason, I think, because it's such a humble beginning for such a big idea as a land ethic.
Yeah. What do you find most enjoyable teaching people that come there?
Well, I like the conservation impact that we have, and I like inspiring that in others. And so we work pretty hard through another project called My Wisconsin Woods to take what we have learned here and use it to inspire other people to take similar action, recognizing that, you know, they have different tools and opportunities than we do. We have, you know, 4,000 acres is not enormous, but it's also not small, but most landowners have about 40 acres. And so putting it into their context, having them leave with some inspiration for what they might be able to do on their own property is powerful for those that own land. For for those that don't, I think it's really fun to have them connect with nature and see, again, that this is accessible to them, that if they currently don't have a relationship to nature, it starts with an observation. It starts with just realizing that there's something going on out there that you could learn about, appreciate, respect, and eventually care for. So we have things like a phenology calendar that we sell every year that is just a wonderful, it's data that Leopold collected in his time, but also that his daughter, Nina Leopold Bradley, collected in her lifetime that are on that calendar. And again, tip people off to what's happening out in nature, but also make them more observant and build that relationship to nature. So there's a lot of entry points, depending on what they're coming with.
Yeah. Go ahead, Jim.
I was just going to joke around. Did you mention in the calendar Mark recapture studies on chickadees like he was doing?
No, but we do have plenty of Leopold references in there. And so it is something that people really enjoy using year after year and keeping their own data.
How did he fit 5 kids in the check?
Well, you know, rumor has it that they rolled them up in blankets, and it was a game to see who could make it through the night without having to get out of your blanket and disrupt everybody and to go to the bathroom. So they managed, and not only that, but they would bring friends. And so it was a mass of humanity in the evenings coming into the shack.
So tell us about this land ethic in action. It's on your website.
Well, you know, that's our way of, again, referencing that the land ethic is this great idea, that we are to see all these pieces and parts in nature as part of our community, therefore have some moral, ethical responsibility to care for them. But to put it into action, and how do you do that? And so, yeah, if you've been to our website, it is brand new, and that land ethic in action portion of our website is intended to grow and grow by leaps and bounds. We really want to profile that the land ethic is out there in many different settings and not just caring for land at a landscape scale of 4,000 acres or 400 acres or 40 acres, but working in the inner city, working in very urban communities, connecting with indigenous interests and inclusion of other thoughts and perspectives on how land can be cared for and values for a relationship between people and land. So that part of the website is intended to grow.
Yeah, it says it's to address global conservation needs, declining populations of birds, pollinators, climate adaptation. Right.
Yeah, well, that is our particular Leopold Pines Conservation Area. That's the example that's up right now. It's a bit of a placeholder for ourselves, and it's our own story. And, yeah, those are the things that we're interested in doing here on our property is to address declining populations of birds, as I mentioned, with the grassland and savannas, their habitats that we're creating for those particular species, but also pollinators and addressing climate change adaptation. And so, you know, for many people, when we say, you know, pre-settlement condition, or we say, you know, what was here 150 years ago, it feels like we're taking somebody back in time. We're fixing up a 57 Chevy. It's this process of nostalgia. That's not at all what we're talking about. And I want to make that clear to your listeners that, yes, it's important to look back so that we could look forward and have some idea of what might be appropriate in our particular locale. But to make sure that the goals that we set for our property and our sort of are looking forward and addressing what is expected to be a changing climate. So, you know, what's all happening out there, we're not sure of. But what the reports tell us is that by 2050, which is not that far away, Wisconsin is going to have the climate of Arkansas. And I have not spent a lot of time in Arkansas, but I did have a meeting down there one time, and they had a quarter inch of snow, and they canceled school. So that's not, you know, that's not how we treat winter in Wisconsin. So a big change is coming.
You really believe that? You think that's going to happen?
Well, this winter was exceptional in many ways. I don't know, you know, what the timing is going to be. I'm just trusting the models, but what the model tells us is that we are going to get warmer here in Wisconsin, drier, although we are going to get more rain. on the whole, over the entire year, it's going to come in fewer events, and so therefore we're going to have longer drought. So that's kind of confusing if you hear that we're going to get wetter, because that is true on the annual basis, but on a per event basis, they're going to be farther apart, and therefore we're going to be drier and have longer drought cycles. And so our pushing the land or coaxing the land through our conservation efforts towards prairie, savanna, oak woodland in our particular case is planning for the future and really should sit well with where we expect to be in 2050.
So what are some action items that your board or conservation committee or whoever is making decisions on this land is discussing about this or even implementing?
Well, you know, that's been kind of a fun thing is it's been a bit of an evolution for us in our thinking. I mean, I think it's pretty easy, again, for a lot of landowners. And I think our early foundation's actions mirror a lot of what we see with private landowners in our work is that although landowners, and I think most of the general public realizes that conservation is out there and conservation implies some action, most landowners, as it's been said to me by one very insightful landowner, I fell in love with my land just the way it was. And so I think that was part of our early history here, too, is that we were very comfortable taking an old farm field that was not very productive and just had old fields on it and restoring it to prairie. That was an easy decision to make. Cutting trees by the acre, or in our case, by the 200-acre or the 400-acre, was a major shift, you know, for our board and family members to come here and see stump after stump on the land. It had to be more than just about the money. It had to be about the conservation impact. And so that's part of our evolution. It's getting more comfortable with the landscape being in a condition that aesthetically, you know, is a little hard to swallow at the moment, but being able to see what's on the other side has been valuable. And so we collect data. We have to make sure that our impact is there, because otherwise we're sort of not living up to the promise, but we're also not justifying our actions to our stakeholders like the board and the public. And so we have gone back into these areas where we've done several hundred acres of significant harvesting. And sure enough, the birds that we were hoping for, like the red-headed woodpecker, blue-winged warbler, black-billed cuckoo, little flycatcher, those are some of our indicator species in our savannas, that in fact they are there. And so that's been very affirming of the effort.
What do you think would have more impact? We've talked about this before, but on the radio show. What do you think would have more impact, doing nothing or the forecasted climate change?
Because this is
kind of the crux of the matter is, you know, they told us in New York State we should be preparing for oak. We don't have oak regeneration. It's not going to happen without disturbance or cutting or burning. We're having maple. We have red maple. We have sugar maple. We have beech. We have those mesic hardwoods coming in. We don't have those xerophytes coming in. Sure as hell not going to get jack pine or pitch pine or sassafras anytime soon. So you know what I mean? Like, this is kind of like that point where the public foresees climate change as being the significant hurdle, whereas I think it's our land use culture that is the most. We're acting as though it never happened almost.
Well, you are right that problem of the mesification of the eastern upper, you know, the eastern landscape, the eastern woods, is a real issue. And I think it's important that those species that will respond to a warming, drying climate be on the landscape in sufficient quantity that, you know, it can recover and there's some resiliency there. If the species aren't there, the species aren't there. And so it is important that we maintain enough diversity across the landscape in meaningful size and also hopefully in some north-south, lines and connections that allow for these species to migrate through climate change. But you're right. I mean, I think change is coming.
What if they never really migrate as much as we think through climate, but humans? I mean, you know, Steiner, I think wasn't he a professor at University of Wisconsin? I think we had him on the show. Steiner? Steinman? He used to talk about Wisconsin losing their oaks. You have mesification going on there and a drier. You guys get less than 40 inches of rain, which to us is almost a desert. So, I mean, you know what I mean? Like, I just don't understand how you really think you're going to get oak without burning or cutting.
Well, you're absolutely right that it's going to take active management in order to create a place for oak regeneration that we see. We see across our landscape as well that it's those places where oak is doing well, they are the drier, more xeric sites, and there is active management going on, and there is, at least for the beginning, some real effort to control competition and make sure that the site is not lost again to ash or maple species that come in very quickly. So it takes work for sure.
Yeah, if you want to come on again, we could get more into maybe the fire and some of those practices. But only got a minute left. This is one problem of having a 1-hour radio show, right, John? Is that we could? I think we could talk to him a lot longer. What do you want to leave off with? How can people find out more about the Aldo Leopold Foundation?
Well, thank you for an opportunity to do a little plug here. I would love it if you visit our website, aldoleopold.org. And you can do a couple of things. One, you can buy a copy of a Sands County Almanac. If you have never read it, it is a collection of essays, so you can pick it up and put it down at will and enjoy it. And so it has never been cheaper, and it's nowhere cheaper on the planet than right now at the Aldo Leopold Foundation in celebration of its 75th anniversary, which is this year. We're offering it for $7.50, which is about 60% off the cover price. So buy a copy of a Sands County Almanac if you've never read it. Buy two copies and give one away. You will not disappoint the person who receives the gift. And then secondly, we do have this ongoing conversation, and we do it through virtual programming. So all of the listeners out there in New York can join us for our next online virtual program. It's April 11th. We're going to have author Ben Goldfarb on. Really thoughtful journalist, environmental journalist, really wonderful individual. And he has a new book out, Crossroads, and the byline on it is How Road Ecology is Shaping the Future of Our Planet. So really looking forward to him. But our virtual program series, which is monthly, is our way to bring the land ethic, this transcendent idea to the current issues of the day. So join us for that program on April 11th. Buy a copy of the Sand County Almanac.
Steve, thank you for taking the time and coming on. And enjoy your night, and hopefully we can get you on again. Talk about maybe fire or some of the specific practices you guys do there.
Yeah, I would love to be on the program again. And John and Ryan, I really appreciate your time and having me on the program. So thank you very much, and have a great evening.
All right, have a good night. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
All right, if you missed the show, that was Aldo Leopold and the Importance of Conservation with Steve Svensson. Have a good night. Good night, everyone.
The sidewalk as he stumbled in the street. A dozen faces stopped to stare, but no one stopped to speak. For his castle was a hallway, and the bottle was his friend. And the old man stumbled in from the forest. Up a dark and dingy staircase, the old man made his way. His ragged coat around him as upon his cot he lay. And he wondered how it happened that he'd ended up this way. Sidewalk as he stumbled in the street. A dozen faces stopped to stare, but no one stopped to speak.